This is the Education Exchange. I am Paul Peterson, Senior Editor at Education Next. Thank you for joining us. Charter school enrollment grew steadily throughout the 21st century, so that by 2019, approximately 7% of American school children were attending a charter school. Unlike school vouchers, charters receive bipartisan support, and much of the charter school growth has occurred in blue states such as California, New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. Charters are serving a disproportionately minority population, and they have shown steady improvement at lifting student achievement, especially for African Americans. But charter school growth has slowed in the past few years. Many charters were closed during COVID. And recently, charters seem to have lost their footing. Recovery from the pandemic has not been as fast as many would have liked. Teacher unions have stepped up their opposition, and it's not clear that learning at charters is continuing to improve. So to discuss these issues, I have with me on the Education Exchange today, Stephen Wilson. He is the founder of the National Summer School Initiative that seeks to build teacher capacity in both district and charter schools. He's well known for his critical role in founding Ascend Learning, one of the country's most successful charter school networks, and is located in central Brooklyn. He's a prolific author, and his latest book, or at least I should say his forthcoming book, tentatively entitled The Lost Decade, Returning to the Fight for Better Schools, that's scheduled for release this coming fall. So thank you, Stephen, for joining me on the Education Exchange.
I'm delighted to be with you, Paul. Great to see you.
Well, Stephen, the tentative title of your forthcoming book is The Lost Decade. Well, we've known we've had school closures for a year or two, but why do you say a lost decade?
Well, I would point to a change in what schools in the reform movement are driving toward. You know, for a long time, the essence of urban charters in the KIPP mold, which inspired many other networks that boast the kind of results that you described at the beginning of the segment, the essence of that was we are going to do whatever it takes to advance student achievement. We're going to attend to what was called the 101% solutions, because there's no silver bullet for raising achievement. You have to do a lot of things well. And really internally, the test for every decision in the organization, in the network or the school, was, does this advance student achievement? But now that has really changed in many places, as what I would call social justice education has begun to substitute for the focus on an academic education. And the new test of decisions is the decision that we're about to make as anti-racist as possible? It's a very different criterion for internal decisions. So in the largest sense, academics are less of a focus, and the new focus is on social justice.
So that's a really compelling argument. But let's talk about the early days. You mentioned that everything was done with student achievement in mind. So can you describe, at Ascend Learning and other schools like it, what were you doing to maximize student learning? And really all the data out there says that kind of a school was very successful. Ascend Learning Network schools were great, but it wasn't the only one. There were many others out there like it that were also effective.
Right, many that were much larger and much more successful. But the essence of what we all had in common is, first of all, we were operating on what I would call an operating system that was much more favorable to student achievement than district schools. And that operating system is the charter bargain, which is to say that in starting a charter school, you have a degree of authority and autonomy to do things that really matter, like being able to hire and fire your faculty of your choice, being able to choose the curriculum that works best, control your budget, all things which principals in traditional large urban schools have relatively little control over. So can we just imagine, Paul, in any other sector of activity in this country, if you were to say to the CEO that you can't control your budget, you can't control who you have working for you, obviously people would say, well, of course I can't deliver results. So The charter bargain was this fundamental change in the operating system on which we could build good schools, but then you need an effective program. And that was a much more rigorous curriculum that you would see in these schools, enormous attention to who was in the classroom, an outsized investment in teacher professional development in preparation to teach, both new teachers and returning teachers each year, a degree of internal accountability, frequent assessment, unalloyed conviction that testing matters and is our guide to whether students are actually learning, all of those things. And of course, a very important cultural element. So many urban schools, when this all began in the early 90s, were absolutely hobbled by not just, and this is the first part is what people remember, outright violence, gangs, drugs, were things that parents were very deeply worried about. They didn't feel that their children were safe. But the larger problem was the low-level disruptions in the classroom that make it impossible for students to learn, because there's always something happening which is taking the attention away from learning. And these schools, beginning with KIPP, put a focus on saying, we're going to have an orderly, engaging classroom where students can achieve a little bit of academic success reliably every period. And those little successes add up both academically, but also in terms of student motivation and commitment to the learning project, lessening alienation from schooling, lessening anomie, really being engaged in the sense of a learning community. So those were some of the big drivers.
Well, did you actually see lower absentee rates? And there was a lot of talk these days about chronic absenteeism. And so you talk about more commitment. Do you feel like the charter schools of the kind you're talking about, they're actually were getting kids to school every day, not tardy the full day? Was that one of the things that you...
Oh, absolutely. A huge dimension. Time on task matters enormously. Attendance matters enormously. You mentioned tardiness. I mean, this is a good example. Every dimension of the school was engineered to maximize learning time. A lot of attention to what are called in the school world procedures, which sounds horribly dull, but turns out to matter enormously, the way students participate in what's called arrival, the beginning of the day, how they're greeted, how do they get to their classrooms efficiently, how does the class start on time, how does learning begin immediately rather than after 15 minutes. All of these procedures make a huge difference, and they're all geared towards maximizing learning.
Well, I was just at some charter schools in Hawaii, and these were schools that were conducted in the Hawaiian language as part of the Hawaiian Renaissance. They're trying to bring back the idea that the Hawaiian language is a language well worth speaking and preserving. And one of the things they do every morning, all the students must participate in protocol. I call it prayer. There's some dispute as to whether it's prayer, but they're definitely talking to gods. They're evoking the gods of the Hawaiian past, whether it's the fire, Madam Pili, or whether it's the god of water or earth. But they are clearly making arrival at school a period of devotion, and it frames the mood and the atmosphere in a really remarkable way. Is anything like that ever attempted at a charter school?
I think everything that's a very central part of it. Charter schools were very audacious in the sense of saying, we are going to create a distinct culture, which is separate and apart from that of traditional schools. It's going to have very strong values, very strong commitments. The most important one is that every child is going to college. And that message was reinforced from the day one, from the fact that each of the classrooms bore the name of the alma mater of the teacher in the room. They were pennants of schools hanging in the corridors to reinforce this sense that our community has a special destiny. We're doing something very special together. We have a mission, and our mission is achievement, opportunity, college, and a great life. And that clarity is critical in any institution. it's all about the mission, the clarity of the mission, the conviction of the people that work there, what we might call the subscription of everyone. It's the idea if they stop anyone in the hallway and you say, what does this school stand for? They'll give you roughly the same answer, right? That's an essential ingredient. And charters were very effective, urban charters, I should say, very effective at achieving that singular sense of focus. But as I said, that has really eroded over time in recent years.
So just before we get to the erosion.
Sorry, I'm getting ahead of the story.
I want to bring up one criticism that I always have heard about this modality, this approach, and that is, aren't you suspending students, expelling students, chasing students away that don't fit this thing, and so that you're getting an unusual group of students in the charter sector, and therefore mainly what the success is all about is just who survives the stringent controls that have been imposed upon them?
Well, this is a fantastic question, and we could devote a couple episodes to that question alone. But so we should just be clear that there's no evidence that schools, that charter schools, select their students in the sense that it's always conducted by lottery. These lotteries have been audited many, many times. And these schools tend to, in fact, enroll a disproportionate number of students who are Black or Hispanic, low income, et cetera. Now, as for special education and multiple language learners, these percentages are roughly comparable with the districts that they come from as well. But it remains the question of whether, as some critics would say, more motivated parents are choosing to enroll in them. By the way, they're not enrolling higher achieving students, who have higher initial achievement. That is also not the case. So those kinds of dimensions have been studied very thoroughly. The motivation factor, of course, is harder to assess. But I would say to you that motivation is not like a precious metal in the ground that there's only a finite quantity of, and then you have mined all of it. This is a fundamentally condescending notion. The very premise of the question is patronizing. Parents all care about their students. Now, they may be early adopters, but as more parents make these alternative choices, there are plenty more parents behind them that are also motivated to get a better education for their kid. And Paul, if I could just say, and even if you don't buy that theoretical explanation, they have been lotteried in, lotteried out comparisons where all parents who participated in the lottery were motivated to do so. Some got in and some didn't. And the ones who got in who had the treatment effect were much more successful.
So where does this idea of a new mission that you mentioned at the beginning, the lost decade, you say this has changed? Now, given this commitment, given this success story, why is there a change developing within this very sector? Is it being forced upon them by state legislatures or by some kind of external pressures, or is this coming from within the charter sector?
It's not coming from within so much as it's coming from new employees. So if we think back to 2008, when Teach for America was at its peak of popularity, 11% of the graduating class of Yale applied to be part. Teach for America was thought of as a very sexy, exciting thing to do. Well, that changed. It began to change with a change in the culture on campus, a turning away from a liberal education. The trends go very deep. The precursors go very deep. If you look at postmodernism theory, critical race theory, and so on. But there was a new progressive left that emerged that did not subscribe to, that was wary of traditional liberal arts commitments, the idea of exposing students to multiple competing points of view, to have kids spar with different ideas. And the focus on remaking institutions, namely schools or networks, shifted. Now the focus was on eradicating racism, which was identified as the cause of the disparities in educational outcomes. So that's a very different premise. In the previous premise, it was the cause of poor, of the disparities that everybody laments and views as intolerable is that they're getting a bad quality education. The new school of thought was that the cause of the disparities was racism, and that can be dressed up as structural racism or systemic racism, but it racism as the cause. And the passion was for addressing racism. And then this gathered further steam, of course, with the murder of George Floyd and the racial reckoning, where the ideas of Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo and so on took on enormous force both on campus and in these networks. And those ideas are in very substantial tension with the traditional commitments of no excuses schooling.
So in what way do they basically say we do not need to require students? I mean, I can see that you can believe in institutional racism and still believe that the way out is by having a classroom environment that's a learning environment, and you can, and that how you come to school really counts. All the things that you laid forth, why is that, why is a concern for institutional racism? You could just say that's why we have the neighborhood schools that are run by school districts. It's because of a history of racism and people did not attend to the education of minority students who were living in poverty in the central cities of the United States. And so I don't see why these two things have to be opposed to one another.
Right. So if you think of anti-racism in the way that you're thinking, of course, the people who started these schools and networks, the Dave Levins and Mike Feinbergs and Daisha Tolles of the world, this was their driving purpose, was to achieve racial equity when there was none. And these schools were unrivaled engines of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But in the new school of thinking, it was quite different. So one important difference, Paul, is that one of the biggest driving factors in the success of these schools was their order and their discipline in a positive sense. But there was a lot of concern from the new progressive left, for the lack of a better term, that these disciplinary approaches were racist, were controlling Black and brown bodies. And so there was a considerable criticism of those practices. So that's one thing. Secondly, the very premise of no excuses education was not, as people imagine it to be, that it was not allowing for children to make mistakes or to do bad things. Not at all. It was that adults are not going to make excuses for why students aren't learning. They weren't going to invoke poverty. They weren't going to invoke racism, the community, et cetera. Not that all of those were not factors. And at the very least, very strong antecedents, as you mentioned, Paul, historical factors. But instead, they were going to say, despite all that, within these four walls, we can have outstanding results. Social justice educators do not accept that premise. They want to focus on racism as the cause of low performance and say that it must be addressed first. So what started happening is that you started having trainings internally facilitated by outside consultants who tried to address things like implicit bias among the educators in the building, who critiqued the disciplinary systems, who critiqued the curriculum, and basically did an entire audit of the school's practices to identify what they saw as potential racist dimensions. And let me just say that racist dimensions included things that we would take as absolutely ordinary, if not admirable, the notion of excellence, the notion of urgency, the notion of objectivity. All those things were now deemed to be, quote, symptoms of white supremacy culture. So you can imagine what it's like in a school of all places where you start saying that that good writing, what is called in the anti-racist literature, love of the written word, quote unquote, is a white supremacist symptom of white supremacist culture. I mean, this is an extraordinary statement, and also a deeply anti-intellectual claim to make. So what kind of message is it to send to marginalized students that love of the written word is whiteness and something that they shouldn't venerate and be driven to achieve themselves?
Stephen, I'm aware of this argument, and I know that it's being articulated on college campuses. I have to listen to that kind of conversation on a regular basis. But how does it penetrate into charter
schools? Oh, it absolutely penetrates very deeply. It is the very same trainings using the very same materials. So at Harvard, there was a whole set of resources since taken down, but that were on the Harvard website, that put up the very same authors and materials. Everybody's using the same things with the same language. This list of supposed characteristics of white supremacist culture are in circulation both in elite higher ed institutions like Harvard, but also in community colleges, also in all New York City educators were trained in that very same dictate a number of years ago. So it's very, very pervasive. And when you introduce that in, and then I will stop on this point, but when you introduce that into these kinds of high-performing school networks, you can imagine it introduced a tremendous amount of rancor because longstanding staff members did not conceive of themselves as racist. They had extraordinary results in their own classrooms, in the schools that they ran as principals, but suddenly they were being called out as effectively racist.
I'm aware that this is going on. I have a very good friend who is very active in the educational system in New York City, and who has told me the inside story of this process, not within the charter schools, but within the New York City school district. And you're absolutely right. This is nothing very unusual. This is at least on the East Coast and maybe the West Coast. But is this happening across the country, or is this sort of something that is limited to these sort of more advanced parts of our country?
Well, I think that the truthful answer is we don't really know how pervasive it is. We know that it is very present in these highly successful alternative school systems that we've been talking about. And that's very worrisome because these systems, as you said, are producing or were producing results that were really unrivaled in the last century in terms of educational effects. So something that we should be protecting with every bone in our body. But in other situations too, I mean, the Buffalo Public Schools has an enormous initiative of this kind that I've been describing. So it is most large systems have a chief equity officer of some kind. And again, I want to be careful. You know, equity is a very, very good thing, but that's what we all thought we were doing, right? We were advancing equity by offering children an exceptional education. And the results were stunning, by the way. KIPP, the most recent Mathematica study that, of course, you're aware of, but for our listeners, KIPP students who attended both a KIPP middle school and a KIPP high school were achieving college, four-year college graduation rates just about equal to white non-disadvantaged students. So, you know, really a remarkable record.
Well, yes, indeed. But now, is there evidence that these schools have, in fact, become not as effective? So you're telling me that the mission is changing within the teaching staff and the administrative staff of these schools that have been so successful, but do we see anything in terms of student achievement that suggests this is all that harmful?
Yes, and let me just say that I want to make sure, Paul, to mention that the other strand that is occurring here is a turning away from academics and towards therapy. So part of the premise here in social justice education is that marginalized children are, to use the term of art, traumatized, and that we first need to attend to their trauma and also the trauma of their teachers before we can return to focusing on education. That is a very problematic message, as is the message of deep fragility. The message of no excuses education was one of optimism, that children are resilient, that the world is full of promise and opportunity to them. And the message of social justice education is very pessimistic, that the world is rigged against you. So to your question of results, what we are beginning to see anecdotally is that very high-flying no excuses schools, by the way, they would not like that label, but I'm using it in the absence of something else, that these high-flying schools are started to turn in results that had often plummeted since the last national testing, 2019. So testing was resumed in 2022 and then given again in the spring of 2023. And in some of these schools, the results had plummeted often to the level of the surrounding district, which of course they had not only vastly exceeded, but they were performing on par with middle-class schools statewide. So now you might say, well, they had closures, there was COVID, but why would they have fallen so much more than the school systems that they compete with? Both institutions suffered from school closures and the other pandemic effects.
So let's turn to the future. You say in the subtitle of your book, you at least your tentative title talks about returning to the fight for school reform. Returning sounds optimistic. You are saying we can turn again.
I think we can.
Return.
Yes, and the reason I call it the lost decade in that working title is because there's a tremendous amount of institutional investment in this new turn towards social justice education and towards racial essentialism. And it will take time to turn back to a focus on excellent academics. But I think that we're at the point where we're beginning to see cracks in the facade in this commitment. A lot of people of all kinds of ideological predispositions are beginning to question what has happened. You know, if you think about it, during the racial reckoning, we had so many different ways that we could have gone, everybody sharing a sense of revulsion at the ongoing racism in America and these appalling disparities across race. But instead of adopting the D'Angelo style response, we could have instead said, every child deserves a rigorous academic education. Let us make that our cause. But we didn't, and that's very unfortunate. But we can go back to that. We can say all children, not just the privileged, should have a super engaging liberal arts education where they grapple with different ideas, competing ideas, other cultures, other ideas. That is the most stimulating place you could possibly be. That's the classroom you want to be in. I mean, one interesting thing about this, Paul, is that this kind of education that I've been criticizing is deadly dull. It's a very dreary experience to sit in a classroom all day to be told how horrible things are, and to be, in a sense, conscripted as child soldiers into an adult ideological conflict. Instead, we should be educating kids and exposing them to everything that ignites their curiosity about the world and fuels their learning. And we can go to that. We can absolutely return to that. And that is, I think, what we need to do.
Well, I see two straws in the wind, and one straw in the wind is supports your optimism that we can return. And that's I'll get to the negative one in a minute, but let's talk about the positive one first. And that's the science of reading movement. To me, the science of reading movement, and I noticed that the New York chancellor has embraced it, as so many public school educators across the country. They have embraced the science of reading, and that to me is just going back to something that the high-flying charter schools were deep into when they were so successful.
Absolutely. These high-flying charter schools adopted systematic phonics instruction as much as 20 years ago. And I think particularly of one program, the Engelmann Becker Direct Instruction Reading Mastery, which will reliably turn every child into a decoder. I didn't say a reader, but a decoder by the end of kindergarten or first grade. I mean, it's really quite, we know what to do, and we've known what to do for a very long time. Reading comprehension is another story, but we can turn to that. But yes, I want to just pause for a second to agree with you, to applaud the New York City Department of Education for this bold move, to applaud both the chancellor and the deputy chancellor, Dan Weisberg, for the science of reading. They have required all schools to adopt a systematic phonics program. They give them some choices, and all schools to adopt ambitious literacy program. It could be Hirsch's Core Knowledge Language Arts. It could be Wit and Wisdom. These are excellent choices and will make a big difference. So absolutely. And I agree with you. This is very, very optimistic sign that a science of reading has just overtaken school systems. It's the buzz. It's the right move to make. And it happened very, very quickly. So maybe it's a harbinger of what's to come.
Well, a more complicated innovation, it may be the right one, but I want to get your thinking on this. And that is the whole idea that college is not for everyone. We need to prepare people for a career or for employment in the workforce. That's really what it should be about. And this has captured a lot of enthusiastic applause in conservative circles, that really we should realize not everybody is quite up to the snuff, and therefore we should prepare for a diversity of futures beyond school. What is that caving in to this idea that some people just aren't going to be able to make it, or is that being realistic?
I think it's more the latter. I think that there could be a point in one's high school career, maybe after a sophomore year, where you consider a path towards more of a technical education or a career education. But I don't think it should come prematurely, because then you're engaging in the sorting games that are deeply discriminatory, which were such a feature of American education going back to the beginning of the last century, with IQ testing, later with all kinds of follow-on movements, including the life adjustment movement, and finally the so-called chopping mall high school. These are all sorting of kids. Who are we to sort out what a child is to become and what its potential to be is? So I'm in general opposed. And I think also, given the enormous polarization and fracturing of the American culture, we need a liberal education for all students, because we need students to be able to see the common humanity of people not like them. And we need them to have a broad general education to wrestle with the truly existential problems that are facing them as a generation. They will inherit this earth, including climate change and all kinds of other immense challenges. And we want them to be equipped to be able to participate in the solutions to those problems and not be on the sidelines because we've told them that they're not capable of participating. But the other factor I would just state is that I think one of the misguided notions there is that students will make more money and be more financially successful. That is simply not true. The greatest long-term earnings are accorded to those who have a liberal general education.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for joining me on the Education Exchange.
A total pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Stephen Wilson. He is the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Lost Decade, Returning to the Fight for Better Schools, or maybe I should say tentatively entitled The Lost Decade. This is the Education Exchange. I am Paul Peterson. Please join me every Monday when another Education Exchange podcast is released on the Education Next website at noon Eastern time.